Those of you who play chess know that a stalemate represents a condition when neither of the opponents has sufficient power remaining on the board effectively to check and to take the king of the opposing color. In modern Hebrew, the term for stalemate is teku. The term itself comes not from the world of games and of chess, but from the Talmud. It was used in the ancient academies of Palestine and Babylon to describe the inconclusive conclusion of a long debate on a particular logical or legal point, when neither the yeas nor the nays could finally effectively resolve the issue to the point where they had undone and defeated all the arguments of the opposition. Now, we do not know the origin of the term teku, but there is a pious tradition which says that it is an acronym. That is, that it represents a set of initials taken from the first letter of the successive words of a phrase. And the phrase from which teku is an acronym, according to this pious legend, is this: Tishbi Yitrats Kushyot Vayot. That in the end of days, Elijah will come and he will resolve all of these irresolvable questions. Now, the issue that we place before ourselves today, the question of presidential power, is one that when the bottom line is drawn, we still have to say teku. But the question is beyond a final and ultimate solution. We're dealing here with men and with ambitions, with institutions and constitutions, with all the vagaries of the political situation. And there is no simple or complete answer. Of course, if Elijah were to come, we wouldn't have to deal with the question of presidential power. Elijah, as you recall, plays a major role in our Jewish messianic vision. Just before the coming of the Messiah, he will appear to announce the Messiah's imminent coming. And when the Messiah arrives, every man shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make him afraid. But the Messiah has not come. At least he hasn't introduced himself to me yet. And all of us have been concerned these past months and years with the questions of presidential power. We've watched unauthorized bombings in Cambodia. We've read the headlines of an enemies list, of the presidential use of various intelligence agencies to undermine the power and the position of those in America with whom he was in political opposition. We've read of impoundment. The president has deliberately thwarted the will of Congress and refused to spend monies which the Congress has voted and allocated and appropriated. We have read of secret protocols agreed on with foreign governments which have not passed the necessary required ratification in the Senate. All of us have been concerned by these obvious abuses of presidential power, and the issue is very real. And on a weekend such as this, which brackets the birthdays of two of our great presidents, Washington and Lincoln, just before a holiday which is now being called President's Day, it might be well for us to take a good look at this question of the imperial presidency, of presidential power, of the adjustment of executive power to the institutions and freedoms of a democracy. For even though the bottom line will be that we cannot offer any simple, clear solution to the issue, the very airing of it is sometimes of use, and some greater understanding of the problem obviously makes for a more enlightened citizenry. Actually, the founding fathers had had their way. There would have been no executive. There would have been no president. Children of an age which was steeped in the philosophies of John Locke and of the Enlightenment, disciples of a political tradition which feared the tyranny of the kings of England, the tyranny of monarchy, of royalty. Our fathers met during the American Revolution, as we recall, and they wrote a constitution, the Articles of Confederation. And that constitution made no provision whatsoever for an independent executive. There was to be a judiciary, and there was to be a legislature, and there were to be a number of officers of the legislature who would remain in Philadelphia during the times when the legislature, the Congress, was not in session. But they had no independent authority. They were not in an administration. They were simply men who were bureaucrats at the service of the legislature. But after 6 years, it became very clear that there was too much inertia this way. The great advantage of a president, of an executive, is that it has the right of initiation. It has the power to carry programs through. And unfortunately, in those early days, since there was no administration, nothing was taking place. Each of the states continued to act as if it was an independent sovereignty. The state of Georgia decided that it wanted to go to war against some Indians in Florida, and it involved the colonies and the colonists in terrible problems with Spain as well as with an Indian war. There was great need to repay the war debt owed the French and others in Europe. Because there was no executive branch, there was no way effectively to raise the money needed for the repayment of debts, and that was undermining our trade relations and our political relations with our erstwhile allies. Nothing was being effectively carried forth at the center, at the capital, because there were no bodies in being there who could provide the background, the information, the monitoring, the administration of programs which the Congress devised. Our Constitutional Congress, the group that came together and wrote the Constitution under which we now live, was called together almost entirely because there was no executive. Because under the Articles of Confederation, there was simply inertia, and there would have been dissolution. So the United States, the Union of the States, would have dissolved had some executive powers not been granted to a president. Now, it's interesting to note that our country began with a feeling that there was great danger to be associated with any centralized power, power centralized in the person of a single office and a single man. That our country began in that spirit, and that our tradition reflects a good deal of that spirit, but that both the biblical tradition and the American tradition reflect the inability of any government to manage itself without a strong national executive. I know of no issue which is raised in our Bible, raised and dealt with at length, in which there is less sense of resolution, in which there is less clear indication of an ability to resolve a dilemma than this dilemma of political power. If you pick up the book of Kings and you read the 8th and 9th chapter of the first book of Kings, you come across two diametrically opposed stories which recount the same incident. Samuel's anointing of Saul as the first king of Israel. There's no attempt to adjust these stories to each other. There's no attempt to resolve the differences. There they sit. And if anyone says to you, I believe the Bible, and the Bible tells us this or that in the area of political theory, they cannot say this. Because the first story questions the existence of a king, of a presidency, and the second story justifies and sanctifies the existence of a monarchy. In 1 Kings chapter 8, We're told that due to the victories of the Philistines, the defeats of the Israelites, the elders of the tribes came to the prophet Samuel and they said to him, Atasima lanu melech l'shafteinu k'chol hagoyim. Now appoint for us a king to rule over us according to the way of all the nations that are round about us. We've been suffering political defeat. No one has the power to act. We need someone who has that authority. Appoint for us a king. And the Bible continues, and their petition displeased Samuel. Samuel was not at all pleased with this request. Samuel was a conservative man, and this was an intrusion of a new political form in Israel. But more than this, this request violated the faith which the religious spirits in Israel felt the people ought to have. For according to the Bible tradition, God controls our destinies. It matters not whether there be few or there be many. If God is with the army triumphs. It matters not if there be a king or there be a lack of centralized authority. If God wills, the enemy will be defeated. If he does not wish it, the enemy will triumph. The assumption that some new form of central authority would solve their problems, a very realistic conclusion, ran counter to the lack of realism in the ancient biblical faith. Turn to the next chapter. In this chapter, the institution of the monarchy is deemed to be sanctified by God itself. God causes a number of animals that belong to the flock of Saul to be lost. And God encourages Saul to come to the prophet to inquire where these stray asses may have gone. And in the meantime, he appears to Samuel and he says to the prophet, tomorrow a young man will appear before you. Anoint him as king, as prince in Israel, and he will save my people from the Philistines. Very clearly, the import of this chapter is that God has determined that there shall be a king, and that it is the institution of royalty which will somehow bring about the solution of Israel's political and military problems. And there you have it. Side by side, two diametrically opposed attitudes towards the presidency, towards an executive, towards the centralization of power. The American colonies and the biblical pioneers, the tribes, both of them attempted in their earliest forms to maintain a rudimentary democracy, one in which there would be no institution which could accrue to itself, aggrandize power to itself, and both failed. And we have one indication in the Bible that royalty is authorized and another that it was displeasing to the prophet, to God. But royalty came nevertheless. Now the background seems to be this, biblical background. In very ancient Israel, when the Israelites first appear upon the scene, they appear to us as a rude confederation of tribes. Biblical scholars sometimes call their union an amphictyonic league, a league of 12 or 13 or 11, generally 12 tribes, who come together from time to time for military reasons, who are bound together by vague ties of history and blood, but basically were bound together by a religious covenant which they had entered into at Sinai and had renewed at various periods in their history. There is no king. There is no central authority. When some enemy appears on the horizon, the tribes that are threatened, not necessarily the whole union, comes together and appoints a shofet, or a nagid, a general with a temporary command, and they allocate to this general whatever troops they care to allocate to him, and he is charged with the army, and once the war is over, he is discharged along with the army. He has no power which passes on to his sons. There is no dynasty. He is not chosen from any particular family or tribe. He is chosen simply for his military prowess. And there is no passing on of power. There is no continuous existence of power in the hand of general, president, or king. But then in the 11th century, late in the 11th century, the Israelite Confederation began to suffer from a new set of political circumstances. A group had invaded Macedonia and Greece from the central plateaus of Russia, and they had displaced the original settlers. And these people had crossed the Mediterranean and attacked Cyprus and attacked Crete and displaced those who were in command, who owned the islands. And these people who had been displaced in a kind of primitive domino action of peoples took to their ships and they began to attack the southern littoral of the Mediterranean in Egypt and in Palestine. And these people, whom the Bible calls the Philistines, early in the 10th century established a strong foothold near Gaza. And because they were many, there was a great population coming in behind them, and because they had superior weapons technology, they had the use of iron implements, iron tips for their weapons, iron bands for the wheels of their war chariots. They were able to defeat the Israelites in a series of battles, move up the coast, finally move through the valley of Jezreel, and reduce the Israelites to a few mountain strongholds in the mountains of Judea and to what territory they held in across the Jordan in Moab, what is called today Transjordan. The Israelite Confederation was not only defeated, but was in danger of disappearing off the face of the earth. And under such pressure, it was the sheikhs who came together and who said to Samuel, in one form or another, "Appoint for us a king. We need somebody who will take power into his own hands, who will override the unwillingness of this or that tribe to participate, to pay taxes, to raise the army, who will make the decision as to what kind of army we will need, who will raise money if it's necessary to hire mercenaries, who will save us as a people from being defeated by the Philistines." And Saul was able to do part of the job. And after him, David was able to complete the job. And with David, we come upon a man who was ambitious and skillful, and who went beyond the mandate that had been given to Saul, who became an effective king because he established a new capital, which was his own private property, Jerusalem, Kiryat David, and because he established in Jerusalem an authority which could not be contested. And he taxed the peoples in ways which allowed him to provide for mercenary troops, which guaranteed that he would remain in power against any who might challenge his power. In that way, monarchy came to ancient Israel. It's not in the biblical spirit. Obviously, the spirit that the tribes had brought to Palestine, to Canaan, had been one which sought to live without an administration, but they could not. Centralized power is very hard to live with, but clearly it's almost impossible to live without. Now, when our founding fathers here in America wrestled with this question of centralized authority, when they recognized the weakness of the Articles of Confederation and recognized that they would have to have some president, someone with some authority at the center of things, they tried to enmesh that man's authority, the president's authority, in a system, in a constitutional system, in which there was a clear division of powers, a separation of powers which would see to it that the legislative, the judiciary, the executive branches would always be, in a sense, in competition with each other and watching over one another, that none would have a power which was uncontested and which was arbitrary. Ancient Israel had no constitution of this kind. But reading the Bible, we can see a similar attempt made. Now there is a king. What shall we do with him? Well, clearly the king was not given the power of making fundamental law. There's not a single instance recorded in the Bible where a king changed the fundamental law of the people by arbitrary fiat. And there is a law in the Bible which stipulates, it's a symbolic rule, that every king in Israel was to write for himself a book of the law, a Sefer Torah, and have that book of the law read to him every night to remind him that he had no arbitrary authority. He was under God's law and had to abide by it. And in the book of Deuteronomy, we find a whole series of restrictions of what the king may not do. The king may not multiply chariots, which is to say, he may not have a great standing army with which to terrorize the people. And the king may not sell his brothers into Egypt, which is to say that the king may not do as kings have had a want of doing in those days, impress large bodies of their people and send them off to some foreign country for money or treaty advantage or commercial advantage or something of the kind. And the king may not multiply his wives or maintain an expensive court. And the king is not to live lavishly, nor is he to tax the people expensively. Now, clearly in ancient Israel, many of the kings violated these rules. I read to you this morning the story of Naboth, who had a vineyard in Jezreel. And the king of Israel, Ahab, wanted that vineyard. And the vineyard was one which had passed down through Naboth's family, and he was loath to give it off. There were religious sanctions against giving up what the territory which had been allocated to one's fathers in the original settlement. He refused to do so. So they brought false witness against Naboth and accused him of treachery and blasphemy, capital crimes, and he was killed and the property reverted to the crown. Now there were in those days, as in these, obviously, Washington Post reporters who were able to report on the Watergate issues of the day. It reported to the prophet Elijah what had been done, and the prophet allows the news to circulate and appears before the king and condemns the king in God's own name for the crimes that he has committed. There's a very strong spirit among the people, and particularly symbolized by the prophets of Israel, who represent the religious spirit of the people, which tried to maintain as best they could the various limitations and restrictions of power which had been assumed by the religious traditions, who forced the king as best they could to live under Torah law, to live within the limitations, the quasi-constitutional limitations which had been established. Let's move from ancient Israel to our own day. Obviously, there has been a multiplication of power in the presidency. Many have commented on it. We see it in the remarkable growth of the staff of the White House. We have a sense of it whenever the president passes among us, and before he comes and while he's here and after he leaves, there's a private army left behind to look after his safety. In the days of Washington and Lincoln, almost any private citizen could come to the White House and gain an audience with the president. Today, not even the cabinet advisors are guaranteed that from year to year they can see a president. There's been a growing distance between the presidency and the people. There's been a growing ability of the president, especially in the area of foreign policy, to make policy and to carry it out. We have watched intelligent agencies involve us in activities in foreign countries by decisions of their own. We have seen the president make commitments to foreign nations which were not ratified by the Congress. We have seen the president, for reasons of his own, refuse to provide committees of the Congress or the people information about these relationships which he claims are privileged, therefore arrogating a whole area of power which perhaps had not existed there before. We have seen the president claim for himself and for his people a large area of executive privilege, which denies access to information, both to the people and to the elected representatives of the people. And particularly during the years of Mr. Nixon, but not limited to those years, because the extension of the powers of the president began during the presidencies of Mr. Roosevelt and took a quantum leap beginning with the ambitious presidencies of Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Johnson. During these recent presidencies, people have begun to talk about and to be concerned with what they call an imperial presidency, that so much power has run to and been drained into the administration that our freedoms and the balance of power, which is constitutional in America, seems to be threatened. Now, obviously, there's danger here. And a number of people have suggested a number of remedies, which range from the strengthening of Congress to the growth of participatory democracy at all levels of the country, to a growing diffusion of power from Washington to the state capitals, from the state capitals to the counties and to the cities. But before we accept this single-minded solution to a very complex problem, I think it's important that we recognize what the problem may be. Obviously, the powers of the presidency have increased to a great degree. But obviously, the complexity of national policy, national administration, has increased in similar degree. When Mr. Washington was president of the United States, there were perhaps 10 million citizens of the United States. When Mr. Lincoln was president of the United States, there were perhaps 50 million citizens in the United States. And the United States lived protected by two oceans, seeking neutrality, seeking only to have commercial relationships with the other nations of the world. We were not involved in global politics. Business interests and commercial interests were not involved in all the continents and all the countries of the world. These were simpler times, and simpler times allowed for simpler institutions. Obviously, part of the growth of the powers of the administration are a direct result of a population of 220 million of people, of a national power second to none, of national interests which circle the globe. And I would remind you that at the very time that the power of the presidency has increased, so has the power of our legislative branch. It requires today, I'm told, 18,000 men and women and a budget of almost $1 billion to maintain the congressional branch of this government. All the branches of government, in other words, have had to increase the number of people who work for them, their sophistication of operation, and insofar as they could or wanted to, their powers. The question is a very real one as to what is happening within a clear redistribution of power. It is not at all clear that power is running in only one direction, only towards the presidency. If I read the events of the last decade or so, as I do, I am moved to say that it's certainly in the areas of social welfare and of public policy. A great deal of the economic and the social welfare planning of the United States has moved away from the office of the presidency into independent regulatory agencies, and to the Congress, and to the state government through large block grants to be used by state and local governments for whatever purposes within certain broad categories they designate. In many areas, there has been a flow of power away from the executive to the legislative and to the states. We see this particularly in the inability of Mr. Ford and Mr. Nixon in his last years in office to initiate public policy in the areas of social welfare. They proposed, as presidents had before them, but generally the Congress disposed. And most of the important social welfare legislation of the last decade has been initiated by the Congress. It's their plans which were finally initiated, which were finally voted on, not the president's. Mr. Ford particularly has had very little to say about much of this legislation, except negatively, by way of veto. And Congress has, in a number of cases, been able to pass legislation of this nature over his veto. There has been a movement, in other words, of power in many directions. And I suspect what most of us are seeing when we react to the imperial presidency is not only a redistribution of power within the White House, away from the cabinet, to a number of young men and young women who are appointed by the president to serve his own interests and rather than to serve the interests of various constituencies as head cabinet officers. But what we're seeing, I believe, is that the complexities of foreign policy and the insistence of the president that he and the State Department alone really control foreign policy and the importance of foreign policy in all areas of our national life. Foreign policy conditions and positions now determine so much of our economic life. our relation to the great economic blocks of the world, our trade with the Russians, détente with the Russians, the strength of the dollar. So much of our prosperity is tied up with our ability to export goods to other parts of the world. Foreign policy has become, over the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, almost the preserve and as well as the prerogative of the administration, and very little control was exerted over it by any other branch of the government. There was no check and balance to American foreign policy. And as a result, Vietnam came to symbolize for most of us the dangers of unchecked administrative control of foreign policy. Here were a clear number of decisions made over a decade, costly decisions in terms of tens of billions of dollars and tens of thousands of lives, which involved us in a war which we need not have fought, and a war which we obviously could not fight through to a successful, from our point of view, conclusion. And so many have come to the conclusion that there must be new checks and balances to this foreign political life, decision-making process. And we've seen the Congress in recent months attempt to assert some kind of check and balance, some kind of initiatory power in this area. We saw the Congress cut off aid to Turkey and arms to Turkey when Turkey acted in a way which offended the sensibilities of Congress in the Cyprus dispute. We saw the Congress say no to the president when he asked for one last large grant of funds to Saigon in order to keep that nation afloat and to meet the agreements which we had made secretly, it now turns out, with Saigon at and before the Treaty of Paris. We saw the recent events in Angola when this new international force from the communist world of Cubans and North Vietnamese and North Koreans, which had been seen first in the Middle East fighting Israel, now suddenly appeared in Angola defending Marxist Russian-oriented factions, could not be met by troops supplied at least by the United States and those who support United States policy. Congress said no. Congress read in Angola, another Vietnam, and said no. We've seen it in the investigations of Central Intelligence Agency. The concern that the actions of Central Intelligence Agency involve us in the domestic affairs of other nations is obviously going to lead to some kind of highly restrictive legislation on the activities of those intelligence agencies. Now, what's the sum and substance of it all? The sum and substance of it all is that Congress, for reasons of its own, has taken positions which, in each case, the administration has opposed. It's not a question really of who's right and who's wrong, but the basic question and the basic result has been that American policy has to be in a large degree neutralized. We have commitments all over the world, but our commitments require resolve. They require funding. They may require military support. And when the nations of the world are convinced that the United States will not support the commitments it had made in Africa or in the Middle East or elsewhere, then some predator will move in and will take over. And the danger which has arisen by this erosion of power in the executive has been a neutralization of American policy. And one of the reasons that détente has unraveled these last years, the Russians have moved far and fast, is that they've sensed that since the last days of Vietnam, since Americans have become concerned with executive power, they have in effect stymied the ability of the executive to exert its power. And so in the words that the Chinese like to use about other nations, we've become a paper tiger. We growl, but we cannot effectively pounce. We make statements for the press, but we have no effective answer to a problem like Angola or to the Syrian Palestine Liberation Army movement into the Lebanon or to any other action of this kind. Now, there's grave danger here. There's danger on the one side that if we abrogate all attempts to limit presidential power, we may have another Vietnam. Presidential interests are not necessarily wise simply because a president deems them to be wise. On the other hand, if we're not willing to allow the President and the Secretary of State and the Department of State and Defense to devise some policy for the American presence in the world, we will in effect lose our ability to relate to the world and more be pushed back unto ourselves and lose some very important positions economically, but more importantly, limit the ability of those nations, those few nations which are still now free and independent, small nations and larger but not global powers, to survive. I have no answer to lay before you. It's one of those questions really where you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. It's hard to live with this assumption of presidential power, but it's impossible to live without it. And clearly there's no greater wisdom in 500 members of Congress each acting as his own Secretary of State than there is in some administration developing a foreign policy and having to resubmit that policy to the people every 4 years. There's very little value on a President's Day such as this to bemoan the fact that things are not as they were in the days of Washington and the days of Lincoln. Things cannot be as they were. That America is dead. It died as we expanded to the Pacific, as we multiplied in numbers, as we grew prosperous and as we grew powerful and we began to impose our prosperity and our power on the world and to make our prosperity and our power dependent on what happened elsewhere in the world. We now find ourselves in a troubled world where our freedoms and our opportunities are going to be severely circumscribed. It's not a very nice world, and often the response to the ambitions of others may have to be one which we would prefer not to make. But clearly there are hard decisions that must be made, power decisions, and clearly there must be some power at the core of our government, which allows us to move beyond inertia, to be active. There was no president in all of our history who was more conscious of the dangers of presidential power than Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was not one of the original men who was sat in Philadelphia and wrote the Constitution. He was our ambassador to Paris at the time. But he wrote a great deal about the Constitution, and he, in his office and out, was a great defender of the people against tyranny. To him, tyranny was represented by monarchy and by England. He wrote once in, I think it was 1807, "On great occasions, every good officer must be ready to risk himself in going beyond the strict lines of the law. When the public preservation requires it, his motives will be a justification." Now, what Jefferson had in mind when he wrote this was the need to respond to emergency, to attack from abroad, to the attack of the Barbary pirates. And he assumed that we had a great power vested in the Congress, the power of impeachment, which if a president went beyond his constitutionally prescribed rights, if there was need for martial law, there was need for some kind of emergency action, the public could have a great judgment through their Congress of the actions of the executive and could decide whether or not these actions had in fact been carried on in good faith and whether there was cause for the president to exceed his prerogatives. There are times, given the exigencies of life, an administration must, I'm afraid, go beyond the powers which we might willingly ascribe to them, to him. And unfortunately, we as a people, if we wish to maintain ourselves in this world, must be prepared to live with this danger. I said at the beginning that the question of presidential power and adjusting this to democratic institutions was one which our fathers would have called teku, stalemate. One which to which there is no final, simple resolution. Clearly, there must be new forms of administration within the legislative body and a new reform of its processes. Clearly, they must become more effective in developing monitoring systems of their programs. Clearly, if we are to pass monies down to state and local governments, these must be far more democratic and far more effective than they have ever been in the past. Clearly, there will have to be greater understanding of the international issues and watchdog committees of the Congress over our intelligence agencies and over the actions and commitments of our State Department. But clearly, it cannot all be a system of a question of disarray, where every action of the administration is subject to public debate, angry public debate in which there is no consensus among the public as to what position or what standards should be adopted. I'm afraid that given the times, given the complexities of life, all we can say is what our fathers said long ago when they faced conditions of this time, that there are times when, because of the needs of the hour, one must take the gamble, which is the gamble to allow to an institution large degrees of authority and power, and hope that the men who are responsible for the development of these positions will be responsive to the enough to the constitutional history of our country to submit the decisions before they make them in broad form to public debate, to allow us in a large measure, not only every 4 years, but when need be through the Congress, to question this or that involvement. They'll be careful to be honest with us always, and that having been honest and having allowed us to understand the background of the facts, they will do what needs to be done as they understand it with us and for us. All of us share the ancient fear of power, which one finds so large in the lines of the Bible and the lines of our own Constitution. But given the world as it is, a world in which there need to be all kinds of responses at all kinds of levels, I'm afraid that all of us will live in the years that lie ahead with a strong executive. We can only pray that the Congress will be as strong, the press as vigilant, the parties as developed as they need to be in order to maintain some means of balance and check, in order to maintain some unity of purpose within all the parts of the population, we may go ahead with some degree of hope and success towards the future. Amen.